Blog Talk Radio.
Well, you may throw your rock, hide your hand, working in the dark against your fellow man. But as sure as God made black and white, what's done in the dark will be brought to the light. You can run on for a long time, run on for a long time, run on for a long time. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Go tell that long-tongued liar, go and tell that midnight rider, tell the rambler, the gambler, the backbiter, tell him that God's gonna cut you down. Tell him that God's gonna cut you down. Tell him that God's gonna cut you down.
Well, welcome to Walls in Our Minds. This is Terry Dodd. I'm here tonight with my co-host, Red Beckman. And Red should be joining us shortly. And I'm going to open us with a prayer, as is the tradition here at Walls in Our Minds. Almighty Father in Heaven, we just thank you so much for the way that you bless us, especially here at Walls in Our Minds. You've blessed us with good listeners and good guests, and especially tonight. And we ask that your spirit be with us tonight and go before us in everything that we do and what we say. Take control tonight, Father, and have the message that we bring forward be your message. And we pray all of this in the name of your Son and our Savior, Yahshua HaMashiach. Amen. Well, Vaughn, I'd like to introduce you to our listeners. This is Vaughn in Texas. And Vaughn, would like to start out tonight by letting our listeners know that you are not an attorney, but that, in fact, you did go through and get a certificate for being a legal aide, but that you are not giving legal advice tonight. And you might just start out by saying hello to our listeners and giving them a little bit of background on yourself and kind of give them an idea of how you came to learn about land patents.
Good evening, Terry. Yes, I... My grandfather had some 60 acres of pristine undeveloped land in Texas for about 50 years, and a mutual friend of Terry and I, when I showed it to him, suggested to me that I file a land patent on it, and he gave me a copy of some information that had been provided to him by J.C. Van Kirk that explained the background and procedure for filing a land patent, which I did. And we were eventually forced to sell that property for about a third of its value by the development restrictions in the city where it was located. However, we still hold the land patent on it and conveyed it under a warranty deed, which is only partial title, and so we still actually hold some rights to the property.
Interesting. So what brought you to sell it?
It was a develop or perish situation. My grandfather had been offered $6 million for it back in the 1980s and had turned it down, but there had been so many development restrictions placed upon it by the city that the value was being beat down, and we were at a point where we either needed to sell it to a developer for a third of what he'd been offered for it before, or risk continuing to lose value.
Interesting. But you went out and did this process again, did you not?
I did. After that land was sold, I had a yearning to own some land of my own, so I bought a parcel out in the rural part of the state and filed a land patent on it also.
want to tell our folks a little bit about what a land patent is, and let's start there.
Okay, a land patent is absolute title to real estate. Another name that is it is sometimes given is an allodial freehold. And it basically makes the owner sovereign over his land.
Got it. I know when I looked in Black's, two words are listed there, one allodial and one allodium. And allodial says free, not holden of any lord or superior, owned without obligation of vassalage or fealty, the opposite of feudal. And some explanations of allodial was basically when you hold a land in allodium, and allodium being land held absolutely in one's own right, and not of any lord or superior, land not subject to feudal duties or burdens, an estate held by absolute ownership without recognizing any superior to whom any duty is due on account thereof. Now, I think you're aware, Vaughn, and I believe our listeners are, I've told them a number of times, that I'm a real estate broker and developer and been involved in real estate for over 40 years. And the one thing that really kind of shocked me, because I really didn't understand for many years, or the earlier years of my work, that I was putting people basically really under color of title is what they would call it. You would term it color of title,
yeah.
Because a warranty deed, or a quick claim deed, or a special warranty deed, all of these, none of these really convey without any question, they don't really convey complete title, because there is a reservation, if you will, that the state actually controls it, or the county controls it, and you're just a tenant. And if you look, they call it tenants in common or joint tenancy, which basically means that you have a use right, but you don't have complete and full ownership of the property. And that is referred to as color of title, since it's not full title. Correct?
Yes. It's interesting that you mentioned a quit claim deed. A quit claim deed basically says, I don't know whether I have any rights to the property or not, but if I do have any, I release them to another person. And a warranty deed isn't really very much better than that. It says, I guarantee that I have some rights to the property, but it doesn't guarantee all rights. And
well,
some of the rights that a warranty deed reserves to the state that a land patent does not are taxation, control of usage, liens, easements, water rights, and artifacts. And the artifacts are especially interesting to me, because I've done some pretty extensive research in a related area. The state and the federal government both claim rights to historical artifacts, and if you discover them on your property, you've got to jump through all kinds of hoops with the state and the federal government to be able to have any even partial right to them. And I did some pretty extensive research on the outlaw Jesse James. And one of the things I learned was that he buried gold bullion all over the southwestern United States that is still there. But if you discover it on your property, you're going to have a hard fight to be able to keep any part of it.
Yeah. What about mineral rights?
Well, those those are usually fairly well controlled by the warranty deeds. When you sell property, you can reserve mineral rights that you don't sell, and even though someone else is occupying and using the property, you can go out there and drill a well on it if you've reserved those rights. And I don't know that the state or federal government have tried to, well, I guess they did kind of try to assert some of those kinds of rights in Nevada recently, didn't they?
Yes, they did.
But most of that is handled between individual owners.
What provisions? I need to cut you off. I thought you were done.
Oh, yes. There is an attack on property rights that has been going on for a very long time, and the introduction of the warranty deed was an erosion of those property rights. When I was in high school about 50 years ago, as part of my senior government class, I was required to choose between several documents to read. One of them was the Constitution, and one of them was the Communist Manifesto, and I think one of them was Mein Kampf. And the Constitution sounded pretty boring, and I was going to have to memorize the preamble anyway, so I decided I'd like to learn something about our enemies. So I chose the Communist Manifesto to study, and I found that the abolition of property rights was one of the main planks of the Communist Manifesto, along with the abolition of the right to keep and bear arms and the abolition of religion. And our listeners can witness that there have been major inroads in all three of those areas.
Well, the latter part of that first plank of the Communist Manifesto, I'll just read it. Abolition of property and land and the application of all rents of land to public purposes. And that's kind of what happens with property taxes, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Well, let's talk about the founding documents. What provisions do you find in the founding documents regarding land patents?
The Declaration of Independence asserts a God-given right for all men to pursuit of happiness. And in colonial America, pursuit of happiness was commonly understood to include acquisition of real estate.
Well, in fact, when that was first written, it said it actually mentioned property, and they changed it to in fact, the idea there that was that a person is supposed to be able to enjoy that which they produce. In other words, products that they have invested their labor or investment in, they are to be able to enjoy it. And of course, real property is one of those private properties that they are allowed to enjoy, and that in fact represents pursuit of happiness. So a lot of people don't really know that. I've asked a lot of people that question about what's your perception of the meaning of pursuit of happiness. And, you know, some people get it. Some people recognize that it's related to private property. But a lot of people don't. We've kind of lost that. It's certainly not something that they teach you in this government education system of ours.
That's correct. I didn't understand that connection at all until just recently.
Well, now, our producer, Dr. Kate, is a hydrogeologist, and she's working very hard at fighting some of the battle that where the federal government and tribes and others out there, the fish and game people, a lot of them are attacking water rights. It seems that the globalists are bent to basically steal all of our water and either use it for collateral or sell it to foreign interest or whatever, but what have you encountered there where water rights are of landowners are is in danger?
There has been a push which has been very evident in my county to meter and register all water wells so that we can be charged for the water that we draw from the ground, and that is a means of financing the proposed global government. What happened here was there was a water district set up in the county on the pretext of damming the Colorado River, but the dam was never built, and when it became evident that that water district was being used to meter and register our wells, we managed to elect members of the water board who would protect our property rights. And after a couple of years in office, the members of that board came to the conclusion that the only way they could meter and register our wells was through a water district. So their last official act was to dissolve the water district.
Wow.
So that there would be no mechanism in place to meter and register our wells.
Now, I was kind of hoping that our buddy John from down in Texas was going to call in so that we could talk to him a little bit about J.C. Van Kirk. I do not see John on the board right now. John, if you're out there and one of these numbers is you, hit a 1 to raise your hand, and that's true for anyone else that has a question tonight. If you've called in on the phone, you can hit a 1, and it will raise your hand so that we will allow you to get your questions in tonight. Tell us a little bit more about J.C. Van Kirk, because that's who John apparently gave you the documents or package there on, who was pushing land patents. Who is he,
that's
and what
right.
happened to him?
He was a lawyer from San Antonio, and he was the granddaddy of the revival of land patents in Texas. He was also the reigning president of the resurrected Republic of Texas, but he is no longer accessible. I talked to him one time on the phone when I was filing my first land patent, but in, I think it was March of 1996, there was an article published in a major Texas newspaper of an interview with him where he stated that he was warned by a friend in Washington that the FBI planned to assassinate him. He immediately after that article was published, he disappeared and no one knows where he is. And that is when Richard McLaren, who was the vice president of the Republic of Texas, succeeded J.C. as the president. And Richard was the legal assistant who discovered that Texas was illegally annexed and also pioneered all of the procedures for filing land patents in Texas.
Wow. What happened to his wife?
J.C.'s wife? I don't know. I never knew anything about her. Now, Richard McLaren has been pretty well neutralized also. You probably read some of that in the papers. It was fairly widely publicized. He is in prison. He was originally picked up on weapons charges, but somehow they convicted him of kidnapping, and I have to think that was a set-up deal, but I don't know the specifics of it. He's now in prison.
Well, we've talked a lot about political prisoners here and at Walls in Our Minds. We've got a lot of folks out there, some of which are even friends of ours, that we're working to try to get out of jail. I guess they're fortunate to still be breathing. But, you know, even going back to characters like Ezra Pound and people like Kent Hovind and Edgar Steele, and there's a long list of folks who have been railroaded, if you will. The most recent one is Schaefer Cox, who is a young man out of Alaska who has been wrongfully charged. And the only persons that were guilty of anything that should have been put in jail for were the FBI informants, and they were all criminals in their own right and basically burned Schaefer as a part of a means of getting off the hook for their own crimes. And the FBI just and the federal courts just railroaded him right onto the prison and left his young wife and two young children at home without a father and husband. But according to John Schilling, who was apparently familiar with J.C. Van Kirk, he said that Van Kirk's wife disappeared at the same time he did. And so nobody knows whether or not they met with ill fate or if they knew it was coming and disappeared on their own. We can only pray and hope that.
I agree. I hope it was the latter. But he was already living in San Antonio, and San Antonio seems to be a haven for patriots.
Yeah,
I know some others with constitutional leanings that have retired to San Antonio.
Well, let's talk about Texas for just a moment.
Okay.
There's been a lot of talk about the Republic of Texas. Under what conditions could that be revived?
Well, Richard McLaren discovered that Texas was never legally annexed because the Constitution does not provide for the annexation of a republic. It only provides for the annexation of a territory. And on other grounds, when Texas ratified the American Constitution in 1845, we added a provision which permitted us to secede. And Texas may hold an election periodically. I don't remember if it's every 4, 6, or 8 years. But periodically, there can be a popular election held in Texas to vote on the issue of secession. And one was attempted sometime in the 1990s by the officers of the Republic of Texas. I think that was after Van Kirk and McLaren had already been neutralized. So it was probably done by Darrell Freck and Archie Lowe.
What the clause that ratified the American Constitution?
I'm sorry, I didn't understand the question.
Didn't Texas add a clause when they...
Yes. Yes. There were three other states that added that same clause, and interestingly, they were Virginia, New York, and Rhode Island. Now, Virginia would be expected because they were one of the first states to lead the secession movement back in 1860, but New York and Rhode Island are kind of a surprise.
Now, the documents that you obtained that Van Kirk had had actually you'd made copies of Van Kirk's work, you're going to supply me with some of those documents. So if people would like to get copies of those documents that you've used, if they can contact me, would you supply me with some of those so that our listeners could get access to them?
I no longer have the actual procedure that JC supplied John and I. Somehow they disappeared from my files a few years ago. It seems like those kinds of things seem to be made out of uranium with a half-life of about 6 months. But what I can do is provide copies of the documents I have filed in the process of perfecting my own land patent, and listeners can imitate those documents by substituting the specifics of their own land for mine.
Well, I just put one of my email addresses in the chat room, and for our listeners that are not looking at the switch at the chat room online, that email address is Terry, T-E-R-R-Y, at ASOI.us. That's Terry at ASOI.us. That ASOI stands for All States Organic Initiative. So it's ASOI.us. If you'll send me an email requesting the patent documents, I will see to it that you receive those. Let's see. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about this process of filing a land patent?
Yes. The first step is to find the legal description of the property in terms of survey name and number and abstract number. And that can be tricky because they have changed the nature of legal description, so they are no longer described in those terms. Most warranty deeds describe the property in terms of lot and block. So if that is the case, if your deed is less than about 60 years old, that would probably be the case, and you would have to go to the courthouse where that deed was filed and trace it back through previous owners until you find a deed that describes the property in terms of survey name and number and abstract number. Then you contact the state land office and ask them for a certified copy of the land patent that corresponds to that legal description. And they'll send that to you for a nominal fee. I can't remember what it was in Texas, something like $15, I think. And you can do that either in person at the state capitol, or you can do it by phone and mail.
Well, here in Colorado, the standard real estate contracts have a checkoff box where you can request the title company to supply you with an abstract. So basically, if you're not acquiring the property right now, if you already own the property, you might have two choices of doing that. You can either go to the county records and look up all these previous sales, or you could possibly go to a title company and get them to do the research for you, and they can do a lot of that online, but some of the older documents may not be online. It just depends on your state, but you might start with the clerk and recorder's office of your county and find out how they would recommend that you obtain that information, because the title company is probably going to charge you something unless you're acquiring it now and you check off the abstract and have the seller provide it for you. One of our people in our chat room mentioned about the BLM. They have a process. They have a lot of information on it for land patent for BLM property, but I would suggest that you might be careful. Some property that is showing as being BLM property, I'm not sure they've got the real right to take that ownership. You probably better research that as well. Let's see.
It sounds like you have some pretty good mechanisms in place in Colorado, and I should point out also that each state is probably somewhat different. So I'm describing the way it's done in Texas.
Okay, and you've also described how you've showed others too. You basically
yes.
just showed your documents and let them modify those documents. At this juncture, let me add something to this first step. One of the attorneys that I've worked with here in Colorado, who was trying to help people establish allodial title, one of the things that he found was that with the warranty deeds and the even the quick claim deeds, it doesn't matter whatever they're calling their deed that's granting this tenancy, that the buyers have not accepted the title. It's that those deeds have only been signed by the grantor, by the seller.
Hmm.
And in order for somebody to actually be an official grantee as a recorded grantee and having accepted their claim, if you will, to the property, they need to go back to the original sale and accept the conveyance of title on every one of those and record that officially into the recorded documents in order for them to and then when they complete that process, it would be at that point and on that date that they would in fact become the rightful owner of the property. And that may, not necessarily, but it may wipe out any prior liens on the property. It wouldn't wipe out a debt. They would still own the debt if they signed a note, but if there was, for example, a deed of trust or a mortgage, and they went back and accepted all of those conveyances, and at that time, once they took official title, it could wipe out prior liens. So that's
yeah.
just a thought to add in this step of it. So what's the next step?
Okay, this is where others would need to imitate someone else's filing. And it would really be best if you found someone who had done it in your own state, but if you can't, you can try to conform a copy of my documents to your state, and you draft a document called an Affidavit Declaration of Land Patent, and it basically states in legalese that the attached land patent, which you have gotten from the state office and attached to the affidavit, and it has a patent number and a volume number, conveyed absolute title to the original landowner and to his, quote, heirs, successors, and assigns, unquote, and that the attached warranty deed, which is the deed that you got when you purchased the property and attached to the affidavit, identifies me as an heir, successor, or assign, which therefore grants me absolute title. Then it goes on to state that anyone having a prior claim must file suit within 60 days in a court of proper jurisdiction or lose all rights to the property forever. Okay, when I had drafted that document, I signed and notarized it, attached both of the other documents, the land patent and the warranty deed, and filed it with the county clerk in the county where the land was located. Okay,
okay.
Then there's one more step, and that is to publish in legalese a legal notice in a newspaper that serves the county. And again, you can imitate a notice that someone else has filed by substituting your own information for theirs. And this notice would say that on the given, or my notice that I filed said that on the given date, I filed an affidavit declaration of land patent in the given volume and page of the given county records for the given legal description in order to perfect my absolute title. Further, that anyone having a prior claim of any interest in the property must file suit in a court of proper jurisdiction within 60 days or lose all rights to the property forever.
Okay. So in essence, you created a quiet title condition or an actual or public notice of quiet title, even though you didn't necessarily file a quiet title suit. You've effectively quieted the title by doing that, correct?
Yes.
Was this process expensive? How much did it cost?
Well, it can be. A major metropolitan newspaper charged a few hundred dollars, but my local small town newspaper did it for only $20.
What about the recordings?
Yes, after the notice has been published, the newspaper provides an affidavit containing the text of the notice and stating the date on which it was published, and you also file that with the county clerk.
Okay. You mentioned what your affidavit said, but what about the legal notice?
Oh, no, that last statement was the legal notice. It was similar to the affidavit. They contained some of the same information.
And did you also file your notice?
Yes. Yes, that also was filed with the county, the county clerk.
Now, it's my understanding that if the clerk refuses to record this, that they've actually violated a law. And I don't know if that's in every state or in most states, but it's my understanding that they don't really have a choice to do that. And if for some reason you get some resistance, it's recommended that you mail it to them, registered mail, so that if they return it, you've got documented proof that they've broken the law.
Okay.
Have you been told that?
I might have heard that. I didn't have any of that kind of trouble, but I think I might have heard something like that.
Now, the newspaper will also give you an affidavit that you filed your notice, right?
Correct. Well, it's an affidavit that they have published it, but then it's up to you to file their affidavit.
Okay, so there's three things that you're filing there. One, your affidavit, the legal notice, and then the affidavit from the newspaper that they published it, right?
No, there's only two things. There's the affidavit of land patent, which declares your rights, and there's the affidavit that the newspaper gives you stating that they've published the notice, and it contains the text of the notice.
Ah, right. Gotcha. Here in Colorado, I think they charge us about $5 per page. So how many pages total was involved in your filing?
Well, let's see. I have it right here. Let me count them. I think they charged me $5 for the first page and $1 for each page after that.
So it sounds like you got off for less than $100.
Yeah, I think so.
What about lawyers? Did you use any lawyers for this?
Only to the extent that I followed J.C. Van Kirk's instructions. Most lawyers have been indoctrinated by the establishment and are so absorbed in the system of warranty deeds that they would neither understand nor condone my efforts. Yeah, I counted those pages. It's about, I think it's 12 pages for the affidavit declaration of land patent, and the affidavit, the publisher's affidavit was 2 pages.
Well, for those people in Texas, is there any lawyers down there that you would suggest that might be sympathetic to this cause?
The only one I know of in Texas or anywhere else is Daryl Freck.
Who is Daryl Freck?
He is a current officer of the Republic of Texas, last I knew, and he is the lawyer who filed the class action suit against the Federal Reserve for fraud. He collected information from people all over the country who held mortgages and used that information somehow to file that class action suit against the Federal Reserve.
Do you have any idea what's happened to that suit?
All of his evidence was destroyed by the bombing of the federal building in Oklahoma City.
What? How did that happen? Did he have an office there?
Well, apparently all of the original documents which he had filed in connection with the suit were stored there by the government.
Boy, you would have thought he would have kept a copy of that for his own records, wouldn't you?
Well, he might have, but unless he had each one certified, it wouldn't bear the weight of law.
Yeah.
And there were a lot of them because there were thousands of documents he had collected from people all over the country.
Well, by the way, Red Beckman has joined us. Red, if you want to say hello. Also, Jim Cook and Doug Millar have a live mic and are here with us tonight. They're the host and co-host of Where Angels Fear to Tread, and we're simulcasting with the Crusade Radio here tonight. And I also see a couple more hands raised, and one of them looks like John Shaleen might have finally jumped in here with us. Hey, John.
Hi, how you doing, Terry?
I'm doing pretty good. Have you been listening for a few minutes?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's enjoyable.
What can you tell us about J.C. Van Kirk, this gentleman that you gave the package to Vaughn?
Well, J.C. Van Kirk was really a major thrust on this whole issue out of San Antonio, and I went down and met with him. Just heard me. Go ahead.
Yeah, tell us about that interview or meeting that you had with him, and give us a little bit about the man himself.
Well, J.C. Van Kirk was really a very brilliant man, and he had the legal background for land title and being able to file appropriately in the state of Texas. Now, I don't know as to any other states, but I do know with what he gave us, it was very, very impressive. And he had worked through the legal system to perfect other land title positions. And when we met with him, he was under a lot of pressure from various government agencies that wanted to see him cease and desist from any further actions against the federal government. And shortly after that, he just totally disappeared and have not heard from him since.
Well, Vaughn, I don't think you mentioned where the folks can find Daryl Freck.
Oh, the last headquarters I was aware of for the Republic of Texas was in Meridian, Texas. And that was a couple of years ago, so I don't know if if it's still there or what, but my efforts to contact any of the officers of the Republic of Texas after my first initial contact with them has resulted in recorded telephone messages saying that that phone has been shut down or mail returned as undeliverable. And I just think that that was all somehow done by the system and not by Daryl or the officer of the Republic themselves.
Well, thank you. John, I just wanted you to know that I've left your mic open, and you're welcome to participate here almost like a host, if you will. If you've got a comment or a question at any time, just jump in. Okay, John?
I'm going to sit back and listen to you guys. Thank you.
Okay. Well, I figured, you know, Vaughn and I, if you were here, Vaughn and I wouldn't even have to worry about whether or not we had more to say. We'd just turn it over to you, and all I'd have to do is remember when to tell you when the time's up.
No,
yeah,
really, Vaughn did a lot of work on this himself. And all I did basically is met with JC and then took the package information that we had and gave it to Vaughn. And Vaughn really did all the homework at that point and drove on with it. So that was very good that he did what he did. I only know about the one piece of property, really, that he had perfected title on, and that was, what was it, Vaughn, 76 acres, something like that?
60.
Oh, 60 acres, I'm sorry. And I think the city of Austin wanted to do away with the land title as quickly as they could and put pressure on Vaughn and his family to sell that to them. And I don't think
he was afraid of the FBI.
That,
he was afraid of the FBI. Do you know what that was about?
J.C. Van Kurt?
Yes.
He was, you know, I don't think it's just land title work that he was involved with, but J.C. Van Kurk was doing a lot of work as to the succession of Texas as its own nation state away from the federal government. And, of course, they worked very hard to put a lid on that. That's the reason they put Rick Perry where they put him. That's the reason that they put George W. Bush where they put him. They're trying to stop any of that type of talk from even happening. And those guys, being internationalists, were definitely, you know, trying to keep that from becoming an issue. And J.C. Van Kurk was being very instrumental and being fairly vocal about what he wanted to see happen. He wanted to expose the current system for what it was. And then, of course, since then, the state of Texas has gotten tighter and tighter controls. They're trying to turn all of our state highways down here into tow roads now so that the New World Order will have a funding mechanism. And with J.C. Van Kurk being where he was at, he could affect all those things, and I think he would have effectively probably curtailed at least a lot of their ideals and maybe even stopped a lot of their ideals altogether.
So he was not proud.
I really think that he was really striking a chord with these guys, and I think that they – I don't know what really happened to JC, but I mean, just like he was never there. He disappeared one day, and nobody's heard from him in many years now. I want to say almost 20 years.
Yeah.
No. You mentioned that his wife disappeared at the same time.
Yeah. Well, they both did. I mean, it's like they never were there. It's just the wildest thing I've ever seen. One day they were gone.
You go do a search on the internet, and there's practically nothing there. It mentions about him speaking at a militia muster in 1994, And then after that, it's like he just fell off the face of the earth.
Yes.
And it looks like they, if there was anything on the internet about him, they've scrubbed it.
Well, he was definitely feeling the pressure at that time. When we met with him, he was very, very nervous. And he wasn't just nervous about anybody's presence. He was nervous about cars parked on the block around the house. Oh, I mean, he felt like he was encircled all the time. And I
that reminds me of an incident that happened on my property shortly after I filed the land patent on the 60 acres.
Yes.
I was out there one night looking for trespassers because I'd heard rumors there might be some out there that night. And a uniformed law officer came up behind me and demanded to know why I was there. And I told him I was the landowner. I was looking for trespassers and possibly poachers. And he said, well, if you have any trouble with poachers, give me a call because that's one of my hot buttons. And he gave me his card. And when I tried to call that number, the secretary that answered the phone said it was Special Forces.
Huh. Isn't that something?
Interesting.
Wow.
I want to get into the historical background of land patents with you, Vaughn, but I've got two callers that have got their hands raised. One have been up for a while. I'd kind of like to get some questions in here now, and then we'll come back to that if that's okay.
Yes, that's fine. One thing I'd like to ask John, too, if he can hang around a little bit more, is
sure.
to tell us something about that Spanish company that got the land patent on the 160 acres of gravel pit.
John, let's take the questions from the callers, and then we'll come back to that.
Okay. Good.
Area code 913, you have an open mic. Introduce yourself, please.
Good evening. My name is Sasulu, and I have been trying to get a land patent for my land, and somehow I can't find anyone in here that can do the meets in town. The guy that was going to do the land said it has to be in meets in town, but you know, I tried a couple guys, but he gave me the wrong description on it, and he said he was going to redo it, but you know, he didn't even come back on us. So you know, I just want to find out exactly what I need to have to do a land patent, and how do I go about doing.
Well, we're obviously doing a show on that tonight, and hopefully you've been listening to that, but also, did you take down my email address? If you'll send an email to Terry, T-E-R-R-Y, at A-S-O-I, that's for All States Organic Initiative, A-S-O-I.us. If you'll send me an email, we will get you a copy, kind of a redacted copy that you can fill in your own information on and use as a basis for doing your own filings. Is that what you're asking?
Yes, well, you know, they say that I have to have meets in town. Is that necessary?
Juan, you want to address that?
Well, yes, that should be included on the warranty deed, which you already have, which you would attach to the declaration of land patent.
Okay, so the form that you have for the affidavit of the declaration of land patent, is that the one that I do need for to do my land patent?
Yes, you can imitate it by substituting the information for your property for the information that is on there for another property that has been filed before. You might also like to find on Terry's website a copy of this entire interview from tonight, because we've already gone over some points that you would need to know in addition to having those documents.
Okay. I listened in, but it was, I think it was about 15 minutes late, but I got in and I was listening, and I got your email address, Terry. Thank you.
One of our chatters who's been apparently a little bit knowledgeable of this makes a really good suggestion. I've worked a lot with surveyors and done a lot of things where I've recorded stuff, and it's really good idea to have a surveyor check what you're putting down on the document. If you take it to a surveyor and have them review it, they can check that for you and make sure that your information is correct, and I think that's a great idea.
Okay.
Okay, we're going to move on to another. You had another question?
Okay, sorry. Yeah, I was just wondering, you know, so will I be able to do the meet myself? Is that what you're saying?
You should be able to go to the records and get meets and bounds. If they've got a lot and block on your warranty deed and no meets and bounds, you're going to have to go and look at previous conveyances and go back far enough that you can get a meets and bounds legal description for your property. So that you're going to have to do the research on, and if you're having trouble with that, you can always go to a title company and have them pull an abstract for you and tell them what you're looking for, and they will do that research for you, but they're probably going to charge you something. So if you go to a clerk and recorder's office or wherever your property records are maintained, usually at a county, you can do that for yourself, and all it is your own time. I'm going to go to our next caller. We've got two more with their hands raised, so I'm going to thank you very much for calling in with your question. Area code 405, I think, just dropped just when I was hitting them to let them on, and they dropped. So let's go to area code 512. That's you, John. So area code 704 and then prefix 290. 704-290, you have an open mic. Would you introduce yourself?
It's me, Terry. Steven.
Oh, no.
Did I just ruin your show?
This is Steven from North Carolina. He's a good friend of mine, so I can tease him. I can pull his leg.
Yeah,
do you have
buddy.
A question or a comment, Steven?
Yeah, I was just going to comment to Vaughn about the guy that the cop that snuck up on him wanted to know what he was doing there. I was wondering if he reciprocated and asked the cop what the heck he was doing there.
Well, that was certainly in my mind, but I didn't know. I didn't confront him with that.
It's curious how these public servants have such a tendency to impose themselves in our lives, and we've been trained for generations to just accept them, and that's something that we really need to change. But that's, of course, off the subject. I'll shut up and let you go ahead.
Well, thank you very
Terry,
much for calling
Jim
in,
Cook.
Stephen. Hey, Jim.
Yeah. Hey, Terry, I got a question for Vaughn. What happens if you go back in the records to find out the true number of the property that you're trying to put a land patent on, and it's been subdivided? What happens there?
Well, I think the pieces into which it was subdivided would probably all I'm just guessing that they would all still have the same abstract and survey number that say it's been divided into four pieces, I'm guessing that all four of those would have the same abstract and survey number. But that's okay.
May I address that question?
Yeah, go ahead.
That's correct. And beyond that, Jim, what's necessary at that point is that you use that original language and survey number and abstract number and go to a surveyor and have them describe that particular divided parcel in that context. And the surveyor should be able to give you a legal description for your divided piece based on the original meets and bounds. Okay?
Okay. Oh, now, I recently did go to the county that I was that my property was filed under, and basically I have the book and page number is how they do it in the state of Maine, and I know that you call it a meets and what, Terry?
Bounds.
Meets and bounds.
Yes,
meets and, meets and bounds.
And
yeah, that's just a survey.
I'm sorry?
That's the information that a surveyor provides. In Texas, every land transaction is required to be resurveyed at the time of the transaction. And the information that the surveyor provides when he does the survey is the meets and bounds description, which becomes a part of the warranty deed.
Okay, but what do I specifically need for the patent, the land patent?
Well, for the land patent, you need the survey name and number and the abstract number.
Survey name and number and abstract. And let's say that only was on the original full parcel and not the subdivision. Then I would, how would I get that? I'd have to refer back to that, the original abstract.
Yes, you'd have to trace it back until you found a deed that contained the legal description in those terms, and that legal description would apply to all of the pieces.
Oh, okay. I thought that once it was subdivided, it might prove difficult and how you'd go back to the original description.
It would only be difficult if you didn't go to a surveyor, but the surveyor is basically going to refer to it as a part of that original description with that original survey and original abstract number or meets and bounds description. He's going to describe your divided piece as a part of that. You see?
Okay. Yes, I do, which is good. I thought that maybe somehow by subdividing it kind of like nixed the original abstract number and parcel number.
When you trace it back to a land patent number, that land patent contains many properties, even though they haven't been subdivided.
Oh,
because
okay.
The original Spanish land grants were in hundreds or thousands of acre pieces.
Right. I think the land grants that I'm dealing with came directly from the King of England to the people who owned the partitions in Maine, because I had a friend who owned land closer to the coast of Maine, and basically his parents got the original land grants from the King of England.
Well, that's
okay,
where Texas
another,
and
got,
that's where Texas and Maine are going to be different.
Okay,
we've got another caller. You'll still have a live mic, Jim. I've had you live for a long time, so you can bounce back in anytime you need. Area code 989. You have an open mic. Please introduce yourself.
Yeah, good evening, all. My name is Marvin. I've been curious about land patents for probably 15 years. I'm not sure if anyone is really up to speed on some of the finer details. There's a excellent source of information on land patents from a gentleman by the name of David Wilbur Johnson. He's put out 14 hours of tapes, and last time I seen them were located at 1215.org. That website had them. It's very interesting. But the topic I want to touch on tonight is that our property has been bifurcated here. There are two portions to property. It's the right of property and the right of possession. Now, when you buy something here, you only get the right of possession. You work and work and work, and are taxed half to death. And that is because the state holds the right of property. And there's a federal statute, and I'm trying to think, it's 2409. I'm not sure. 28 U.S.C. 2409A, maybe, that is to quiet title to property. It's a federal statute that you use to go in there and recombine
and
part.
And why would a federal statute have jurisdiction in a state?
Well, because you're in the United States, you're within the United States. Okay.
Stephen Hance, I'm going to let you address that one. You still have an open mic, buddy. Don't be too long on this one, okay?
The federal government, that's part of what I was alluding to earlier in my comments. The federal government has no such authority in the states. They have been systematically trying to assume, usurp that kind of authority, that kind of power, and that's basically what Terry and I do together. The things that we're involved in is putting an end to that absurdity of the claims of federal jurisdiction outside of the federal domain, and the specifically stated authority that it is given in Article 1, Section 8, Article 1, Section 8, the first 16 clauses are known as the enumerated powers, and that's the only power that they have in the state. And this, the tendency is for the past 120 years or so, 30, 40 years, it's been to presume, like the gentleman caller just suggested, is that the federal government trumps everything in terms of jurisdiction and authority, and that's absolute balderdash. The federal government has no such authority. It is something that has been usurped by power of the gun since 1865, and it's an absolute outrage to anybody that understands anything about the constitutional limitations on the authority and the power of the federal government. Federal government is extremely limited in power, and we need to restore that by getting the states back up and running instead of being lying down underneath these Buck Act fraudulent states that have been put on top of us. Now, I'm going to rein it in, Terry, and try not to steal your show here.
Well, that's all right. Well, I want to thank our caller for your question, but that I'm in total agreement with Stephen there. Let's get back on track here, Vaughn. Tell us a little bit about this, the history of land patents and some of the earliest North Americans escaping. What? Why did they came here? You know, they came here to get away from that feudal system, didn't they?
Yes, they did. They were escaping from the feudal system of Europe, and that was an oppressive system because the feudal lords held absolute title to all lands, and the peasants who lived on their lands were virtual slaves.
Well, the so-called lords, they had absolute title to the lands, correct?
Yes.
Terry, is that where lordial title actually comes from?
I have to disagree with you there, buddy.
Stephen, you said you disagreed?
Yeah, absolutely. The lords of the manor held their lands at the pleasure of the king.
Ah. So does that mean that the king then was the only one with lordial title over all the properties then?
Yes, absolutely. The fee simple is the highest form of title that is generally recognized. In a feudal system, that's what fee simple means, is that you hold it in fee simple, which means as long as you pay the taxes, the king will let you keep the land. But all the land in that feudal system was long ago pledged to the Pope. So, you know, the whole idea of land patents is specious, in my opinion, because of the fact that everything in the whole system depends on somebody presuming to have the authority to give away somebody else's land. The King of England didn't own any land in the North American continent. How can
right.
he give them a title to it? That's balderdash.
That makes sense.
The Emperor of Spain did not own the land. How could he give somebody a land grant? It wasn't his to give away.
Right.
Well, I'm the one, this is Jim Cook, I'm the one who brought that up. I think what happened was at the end of the Revolution, when the king signed the declaration or signed the treaty between the United States, he claimed to still have commerce in common with the states. And he still had supposedly, allegedly, bought and owned property in the New England area. That's why it's called New England. Now, the bottom line is, how I understand it, is that because they were still engaged in commerce with the England and the King of England, that the properties that he had supposedly purchased or owned in the United States still belong to him. Yes, he lost the colonies, correct. But what he didn't lose was the property and the commerce that he still had in common.
Huh.
Well, I don't know where you got that information, but to suggest
from the Treaty of Paris, that's where he got that information.
From who?
Wasn't it the Treaty of Paris, Jim?
That's correct, the Treaty of Paris. Now, my friend, who owns a large portion of property on the coast, which is very prime property, his whole family owns the entire harbor area of this one place. And I know that land was passed down and granted to his family. There's no question about my knowing this fact, because I know it.
Oh, you're misunderstanding my point.
Okay.
I don't question the so-called legal aspect of the land patents and all of this, the land grants and all that. What I'm saying is the kings, the emperors, the popes who claim land, you know, the explorers, Vasco da Gama and all of those Spanish explorers, they stick their flag in the sand and claim the land for their king or their queen. And I'm saying, so what? where do you get the authority to claim the land for the king that has been used and stewarded for hundreds, if not thousands of years by indigenous people? It's not their land. So
I think that's a good point.
Play? How are they going to pass a title that they don't own?
Well, you're absolutely right.
When I say I own something, doesn't mean it's mine.
Well, I think the right of conquest has been recognized for centuries, if not millennia.
I understand that. But who says the law of conquest is a law? Was I talking over somebody? I get excited. I apologize.
Just me. You don't have to apologize to me. We started this conversation relative to the Declaration of Independence, and the people of the citizens of the states being the sovereigns here have a right of pursuit of happiness, which is their right to own property. So this is a right that you've got to claim, and that's the whole point of filing these documents, is to assert that right of ownership. And it,
right.
And also the approach here is also including the quieting of the title. And
absolutely.
Once you filed your patent and it is uncontested, then it should be barred, actually even under common law, from anybody coming and trying to take that unless you assign that right away. It's like your own sovereign nation, correct, Vaughn?
Yes, that's correct. When the peasants left Europe and tried to set up a system here that gave them some property rights, what they set up was that every man was qualified to own land by absolute title, and his land was like a sovereign nation, like you said, over which he was king, even making and enforcing his own laws. Some of you people of my vintage might remember the old television program The Life of Riley, where it was kind of the theme of the show was a man's home is his castle, and he is the king of his castle. And the original Spanish land grants were issued under that system. So,
well, that being the case, then, would any city taxes even apply to you, or any county taxes, once you are a lord over your land?
Well, theoretically not, but that would still have to be a right that you might have to assert by defending it in court.
Right.
Against judges who are indoctrinated by the establishment and thoroughly devoted to the system of warranty deeds.
Which means they would still try to grab your land based on the fact that taxes are not being collected on a piece of ground, even though you have a land patent at that point.
Yeah.
I believe we need to explore modifying this process so that it is entirely under common law. And I wish that I think Gus, our buddy Gus, is not on the board tonight, but Gus has been studying this. I'm gonna bring this up to him and some of the others. I know that one of the callers mentioned 1215.org, which is George Gordon's website. They've been doing the common law education for, you know, a long, long time, and there might be some information we can glean from that website. But also Carl Lentz, and who Gus Breton, our buddy, has been hanging out with a lot lately, I believe can discuss this, and I think there's maybe a little exploration that we should look into to make certain that this is compliant with common law, so that if we have to bring a claim against someone for injuring us as a man under common law, being their attempt, for example, to attack our patent, our land patent, or our allodial title, we might be able to defend that under common law and bring in common law at the court. And so that's just an idea I had. I think we've got another hand up. Let's see if we can get this real quick. Area code 949, did you get a question in before, or is this a new hand up?
No, I'm a new hand up. My name is Alicia. I'm from California. Do you guys hear echo?
No,
I don't.
You're coming
through.
Sounds
good.
Okay.
You're just fine.
It's so good. Anyway, my question, I'm very heavily involved in this, and in fact, I just bought a piece of property up in Prescott, Arizona, and I'm going up this in the coming week, and I'm going to go do my land patent thing on it. But I'm very leery about having to do anything with the BLM. Number one, I was at the Bundy Ranch. That's not going over real well, so I'm on one of their lists. Second of all, they're totally federal government to me. So, and I'm so sorry, I missed like about the first 20 minutes of this call because I had to run out for my mom. But so I don't know if you talked about it, but I want to know why I have to request anything from the BLM or deal with them at all. I know that they've replaced or they've taken over the entity that once just handled all of this. Now they've turned it over to the BLM, and very conveniently for them. So I want to get an allodial type title with my land patent. And because they have become an arm of the federal government, I trust them as far as I can spit them. So the information that I have also tells me to make very sure that I do not use any of the land description that the BLM has offered for my property. So I'm going straight by the warranty deed. And I have all my meets and bounds and all that stuff. So that's what I'm going in. But why do I have to deal with the BLM at all?
Are they currently, did you buy the property from them?
Nope. I bought it from a lady.
You need to research the abstract of the title. You need to look and see where the property was originally granted from. If BLM was the one that did that grant, then the only reason you need to contact them is to make sure you've got the correct original abstract and survey number. But other than that, if you've got your accurate information, you should not have to contact them unless you are buying land from them or patenting
no.
land that they control.
Yeah, no, this isn't land they control or anything, even though I am close. I'm close to the National Forest. But,
Vaughn, you never contacted BLM on anything you've done, have you?
No, I have not, but it's possible that things work differently in California.
Well, this would be in Arizona. And
I see.
The BLM is really usurping a lot of this situation, so I am trying to be very careful
all. Ma'am, I've not heard anything positive about the BLM of recent. All they are is an extension of the federal government to make sure that they control as much property as they can, not necessarily even for the federal government, but for the, I think, the international bankers more than anything else.
Exactly.
Ma'am, did you hear me when I gave my email address that people could contact
Terry
me for?
Yes, Terry@asoi.us.
Yes, if you'll send me an email, I've got some other documentation relative to Nevada and Arizona that I will send you. Websites, there's been some work done, some research done, showing that the BLM does not, in fact, own a lot of that property that they're claiming to control. In fact, they're horrible. Yes, they are. And I will be glad to send you what I have that may be informative for you.
That would be amazing. Thank you. Also, I wanted to let everyone know that because I paid tax for my land, I was able to, with all the research I've done, I wrote my own warranty deed, and I wrote it the way it needed to be accepted, because you have to be very careful that you don't accept it from a third party. So I made sure that I accepted it directly from the seller. And my signature, our signature, is the last on the contract. So I was able to do that. In fact, I'll send you a copy of my warranty deed, Terry, so you can see it. I'm very proud of myself, actually.
Well, good. I mean, I'm proud of you, too, just for even making the effort, if nothing else. I can tell you, as someone who is very familiar with and have written legal descriptions on properties and worked a lot with surveyors, it's still a good idea, even if you're feeling pretty confident about the description you've used, to run it by a surveyor and have them just verify for you that your information's accurate. I'd highly recommend that. I've seen a lot of mistakes made, little simple mistakes made by folks trying to write their own legal descriptions. So just caution you. And I think it's great that you're taking that initiative. Thank you very much for calling.
I'm trying to get everybody, I'm educating everybody on how to get off the de facto system. So I'm not only dealing with this, I've taken myself off the driver's license, the voter registration. I'm on a roll here. So what I'm learning through doing it myself, and I'm covering all my bases, because most people don't even understand that the de facto, they think they're so brilliant, but really they're not. They have a contract that lets you in on their records, including the IRS, we shouldn't even be having anything to do with them. They're not even legal. And there is a contract, a de facto contract, to let you out of the contracts they have illegally put us into, like the birth certificate and the driver's license. If you look and you Google those down, you will find that there's a contract for you to rescind all of those contracts. So they covered themselves in every way they could.
It's an election to revoke your election. Because when you file a 1040, but that's getting off topic for tonight.
Yeah, and I don't mean to do that. I'm going to get off now. But thank you so much. And yes, I'll send you a copy of my my warranty deed, and then anything you can send my way would be amazing. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And I'll watch for it. Good night.
Thanks. Good night.
Okay, Vaughn. You were talking about this possibly being tested in court. Are you aware, do you have any knowledge of anybody that's tested this process in court?
No, I don't. And I don't plan to push those points unless defensively, because, like I said in response to John's question a while ago, the judges, like the lawyers, are indoctrinated by the establishment and thoroughly devoted to the system of warranty deeds.
Well, how could your patent be contested?
The only grounds for contesting one would be fraud, and the only entity I can think of that might have grounds for fraud would be a mortgage holder, but I never had a mortgage on mine, so I don't have to worry about that. I can't predict how a court would decide that. They would base it partly on what the court inferred to be my intent.
I think they'd have a tough time proving fraud is not that easily proven. And again, coming back to your intent is exactly correct. What other protection? What kind of protection does a land patent offer a freehold owner?
Well, there is another possibility that it protects you from, and that is that anyone who has previously held a deed to my property might file a land patent to reclaim it, even though he has sold it, if I had not already protected it with my own land patent.
Well, now, we've got an example of that going on right now. These tribes, for example, up in Montana, and they're not the only ones, but they've sold off allotted property, and now they're trying to go back and claim that they still own it because of their Aboriginal rights, even though they were paid for it, and title insurance was issued, and conveyance was granted, and people have built homesteads on the property and the whole nine yards. These tribes are coming back and trying to claim a prior right and saying that that right could not be removed. And my suggestion to these people is that they go through a quiet title situation, which your process here could very well accomplish. I like the way you've approached this. And so if anybody in Montana is dealing with that situation, this would be a good way to kind of prove your ownership. And by doing it this way, they're going to have to watch and file a some kind of protest within the allotted time period, or file a claim within that time period. It's going to force them to come forward and express their claim, which is going to afford you the opportunity under common law to file your claim against them for them injuring you. Really believe one of the things that I'll mention here, Vaughn, that maybe you hadn't thought about. You talked about not pushing those points unless in a defensive posture. I'm suggesting that you need to be in an offensive posture, and because in common law, only a man can bring a claim against another man, and you can only move your claim through the court. So if they are attempting to injure you, you can claim that they are injuring you and go offensively against them with your own claim and move that, and that is a more a much better odds that you're going to be successful. We've been studying this common law stuff, and I really wish Gus Breton was here because he could talk to this better right now than I can. And we'll get him on our show here in a couple of weeks and talk about some of these issues, and we'll come back on this one. And I'll let you know, Vaughn and John and Steve and all you guys, when we're doing that, because I really think there's more to be explored here. And to help people really set it up so that they're not able to be attacked from any direction. Let's close the back door on this is what I'm trying to get at on it. Does that make sense, Vaughn?
Well, I think the best approach that the people in Montana can take is to beat the tribes to the punch in filing a land patent, or even if they don't beat them, to at least file one after the tribes do.
Right. That's my point.
Were you saying that the tribes had filed a land patent, or that they were just asserting those kinds of rights?
They are asserting those kinds of rights. They're doing it. They're really going after it on water issues, but the claims that they're making applies to the lands that they've sold, where people have put. So there are some lawsuits flying regarding the real estate side of it, the private property ownership rights side of it. in addition to
but
the law.
But what right would they really have unless the property was sold under duress?
The property was not sold under duress, and I agree with what you're thinking there is, but what they're trying to assert is that because it's Indian trust land held in trust by the federal government, that if it didn't go through the Bureau of Indian Affairs and get the proper approvals and every I and dot and T wasn't crossed, then they're saying that because of the way the federal law was written, that those people really never took proper title to it, and that their original claim to the property still applies, even though they accepted payment for it, you know, 50 years ago.
Would it not also mean, though, that they sold it out of fraud then? Because
there's all kinds of claims.
Right. Right.
It sounds to me like the tribe.
If they had sold it, right. It sounds like to me the trust would have to reimburse all those people for any cost or any harm caused to them by the fraud that was caused in them selling it in the first place.
Well, the question here
would be a real
becomes,
big mess.
Are you looking
I think
exactly.
fraud is I don't think fraud is quite the right term. I think the Indian tribes have standing to sue the federal government for breach of fiduciary duty or even bring criminal charges for breach of fiduciary duty.
Well, here's something, guys. If the property, if it was sold properly, it should have been severed from the trust first. Okay? It has to be removed from the trust as being a part of the property of the trust. And if that wasn't done, then fraud could ensue.
That's what I think. That's what I think the case would be. Because if it wasn't removed out of the trust and sold in proper standing with all the proper surveys and everything else, that would be fraud.
Well, and no matter how it, whether there was fraud involved or the intent was there to commit fraud or not, they can't have their cake and eat it too.
Right.
And we're talking a lot of time has passed. We're talking hundreds of millions of dollars worth of property here. We're not talking about one isolated case. We're talking
right.
about hundreds of pieces of property.
Oh, understood. It sounds
maybe,
like more
maybe
than anything
over,
else. But
maybe thousands. Maybe thousands.
It sounds like it's just a good excuse for a secondary land grab. And
exactly.
And I think they'll get slammed doing that.
Okay, we've
I
got
don't
another.
Think good conscience they could do that.
We've got another hand up. Let's see what this one's about. Area code, if it pops up here, area code 678. You have a live mic. Would you introduce yourself? Area code 678.
Oh, I'm sorry. I had to take myself off mute. Hey, Terry, this is Carl. How you doing tonight?
I'm doing good, Carl.
Well, good. You guys were bantying around a right special word for me right now. It's called fraud.
Yeah.
And look, guys, we can play around in the courts. I mean, if you want to play and spend money and, you know, have good entertainment, then I suggest, yeah, go ahead and play around in the courts. But they're not designed in any way, shape, or form to be our courts. They never have been. These are creations of the Crown and through the Vatican. You go back to the Treaty of Verona. You'll notice that that's when the then Pope and the Crown got together and just decided, well, you know, we think that the American experiment, it's a failure. So all of these people that went over there, we're just going to call them vessels, and we're going to send our pirates over there, give them letters of marque, and let them recover the bounty and or booty, depending upon where it's located. And
Carl,
well, they did that.
Carl,
yeah,
Carl,
yeah.
You're opening a can of worms. And some of what you're saying is accurate, and some of what you're saying is not exactly accurate. And let me explain what I mean by this. Vaughn's already said he doesn't want to deal with the courts any more than he absolutely has to because they're corrupt. And obviously, you know, we got Red Beckman on here who will quickly, if he was unmuted, I'd let him say his spiel about the fact that especially the federal judges, but most of the judges sitting on the bench are criminals who are beneficiaries of the tax system through their pension systems and everything else, but they're beneficiaries of it, and they are not capable of making an impartial decision, neither on facts nor determination of law. And so we've got a real problem there. But let me come back to one piece of this. The court isn't the problem. It's the usurpation and occupation of those courts by these bar attorneys, which are also bar attorney people sitting on the bench. But the court is still there for the people. But the people have to know how to bring the common law back to that court. And right now, the common law is usable in the court or at the court, but it's not being put to use there because it is being usurped and occupied by the bar. So the people still have the power to bring the common law at court. So it's not necessarily the court that's been. I'm sorry?
You have seen time and time again people like Carl Lentz. And now Carl is just an absolute master at what he does. There's no question about that, okay?
Yes.
But short of having that type of understanding and being able to invoke it in the way he does, the average person is not going to ever approach that level of expertise to be able to maneuver that court into a common law environment. This isn't going to happen. And they know
so
that.
So we're in agreement. We're in agreement on that. However, it is possible if people will get out from behind their television sets and start educating themselves on what they were never educated on in the government schools, including the government law school, the government law schools.
Yeah. Look, what's been uncovered here lately is just it's just laid everything bare, and I'll tell you. We need to quit jerking around and playing these games. We need to reassert ourselves and take those courts back. Okay. Now you know what I'm up to. And by the way, Steve, if you're still on the line, got a couple little things I'd like to talk to you about. So I'll be getting in touch with you. That Board of Review is obviously I'm firmly convinced that is the only way for us to go at this point. And
okay, Carl, wait just a second.
Yeah.
I think we've got about 16 minutes left to go in this show. I don't know if we want to go down this avenue or not. Let's get back to Vaughn, who is our guest, for just a minute. Stay right there, Carl, and Stephen, stay close. Vaughn, was there something else that you wanted to address tonight relative to land patents and allodial title, or we pretty much covered what you wanted to cover?
Well, there's one other significant point. We were talking about the potential of someone contesting a land patent on the basis of fraud, and there is one entity that very likely might try to do that on a broad scale. There is speculation that the global bankers might try to reclaim all lands they have ever held under deeds of trust when they were mortgaged by filing land patents on them. And most of the land in America at one time or another was mortgaged. And their motive for doing that would be to discharge America's huge national debt and to return America to the feudal system that the globalists love.
So, I've heard the same thing. I have heard that being the case.
This is Jim Cook. I'd like to address that.
in prior to 1933, around 33, in 1933, we were bankrupt from World War One. At that time, the Federal Reserve refused to loan any more money to the U.S. government. What happened at that point was they then turned all the property, the federal government entered into agreement with the Federal Reserve to turn all property into paper assets, and all property meaning all businesses, all farms, everything, and then use that as collateral against the debt. Now, that being said, what they did was they never collected the principal on that debt and only collected the interest payment on that debt on all the money that they loaned the U.S. government and used the 1040 form to collect that interest payment. That's why your 1040 taxes go into the Federal Reserve, not the U.S. Treasury. When the gross national product, okay, is, how should I put this? When the debt exceeds the gross national product, then they can claim default and collect all the property of the United States and turn us back into a feudal state, which is what their intent was. But here's the deal. When the federal government entered into that agreement, it didn't own the property that it put up as paper assets, unbeknownst to the American people. That's fraud. So the debt doesn't belong to us anyway, because the Federal Reserve is borrowing the money outside of the United States, like in China, and what they're doing is saying, oh, well, we own that debt. The American people own that. But guess what? The Constitution does not make amends for borrowing money at interest. There's nowhere in the Constitution that it's allowable, which means not only is it unconstitutional what they're doing, but the federal government entered into a fraudulent agreement in the first place, which means that we don't own the debt. And secondly, the federal government never had the authority. We never gave them the authority to use our property as collateral against all the loans that the Federal Reserve made us.
And I believe that that's I believe they recognize that, Jim. I believe that the banksters recognize that they're not going to be able to pull off claiming a claim against things that have been paid off. I believe, and I think all of you have a valid point here. I think Vaughn has a valid point here. But I believe that the way it's going to come down is that they're going to crash this economy to destroy the wealth and ability of the working class of America to pay their debt. So everybody who is indebted to them, when things crash, is going to be subject to having their property taken away from them. And that's the way that they're going to approach this. They would come at it from all of these different directions, but I believe that that's the one that they've resolved as being the way they're going to try to do it. They've been attacking private property rights in a zillion ways. One of them has been making loans that they know people are not going to be able to eventually pay off. And that's going to be the way that they're going to steal a vast amount of the property rights of people when there's an economic downturn, and they're going to force that downturn. They're forcing it right now. And they're relying on, especially I believe the trigger that's coming up are the final phases of Obamacare. And I believe that that's along with them restricting the money supply, which they've been tightening. And one of the ways they've been tightening it is they've been blocking the transfer of international transfers. Right now, if you want to move over $100 million anywhere in the world and you're a U.S. citizen, odds are it's going to get blocked. We're seeing this happening right now in numerous arenas. They've been holding and resisting completing the RV, for example, on the currencies that have not been traded. And this is one of the reasons why they've been holding it up, because, for example, those interests, and I'm not going to get into who those interests are right now, but there are interests out there that are trying to work against this bankster cabal and are trying to do things to boost the economy. And the cabal is using their ownership of all the regulatory authorities, whether it's World Bank, IMF, U.S. Treasury, you name it, they control all of those. They're using their regulatory authority to block a lot of these transactions from happening. And if you can stop, you know, a few hundred billions of dollars worth of movement of currency for a few months, which they've already done, you can greatly, greatly put a stranglehold on the economy of the world. And they're especially doing it for U.S. citizens, or those that, I'm sorry for the use of that term, but those that consider themselves to be U.S. citizens or citizens of the states. They're doing that, and they're doing it right now. And if you look at, you know, like the predictions of Lindsey Williams, for example, on what he got from the oil people, you know, they predicted that, you know, come the beginning of 2015, that we're going to see a tremendous economic downturn. Now, I don't think everything that they tell him is true, and I believe that there are some things in there that they want to scare people with. I think they're fear-mongering. I think there's a lot of that going on, but there's a lot of truth in what comes out of that, too. And I believe that we're facing this right now. The balance of Obamacare kicks in. They've just kicked in FATCA on July 1, and we haven't really seen the net effect of that yet, but we are seeing indications, and they started that, even though it was supposed to be implemented July 1, we saw things happening in June, and if you looked at the paperwork on your, just go look at a W-9 form that they have you fill out when you start an employment somewhere, or somebody's going to issue a taxable event, they'll have you fill out a W-9. Go look at that form and realize that all of the new text that's on that related to FATCA was put on there back around the 1st of June, even though it wasn't supposed to go into effect until July 1. Now, they had delayed it until July 1. It was actually supposed to go into effect like a year ago, but they delayed it because people were catching on and they were getting a lot of pressure, and there's been this counter-resistance. But believe me, what Vaughn is talking about with the global bankers making a claim on private property rights is going to happen. We don't know exactly how they're going to go about it, but you look at everything that they've done through the UN, through the environmental movement, through even the agricultural regulations, what the FDA's done. They've been coming at us to go after those personal private property rights in a myriad of ways, and they've got to crash the wealth and the resisting power of the middle class, not middle class, but working class is a better term, of the Americans in order to achieve their agenda. And their agenda is at work, and it's working heavily against us. And I believe that some of these things, you'll start seeing the net effect of them here in the next few months. But between now and the end of the year, and especially going into next year, it's going to hurt a lot of people. And you can take that prediction to the bank.
Well, you're absolutely right, Terry. You're positively 100% right. But the states have started to rebel. They're passing laws in each state stating that we will not put up with gun laws or property right confiscations and other things. And 12 states right now have nixed Obamacare and everything that's attached to it. And if you go back to the original OMB number on the I-9 form, you'll find that the I-9 form was originally used for migratory agricultural workers and really don't apply to the American people. Now, I've studied this when I was studying the tax laws and things occurred with that. So you're absolutely right. Regardless of legal being or lawful, what they're doing is not lawful, but what they're doing is legal. And it's going to come down to a push and shove by the states passing legislation to totally nix what the federal government is doing.
We've only got about 5 minutes left, and I really don't think we can do the topic justice that Carl was headed down that path. And I would like to invite Carl and Steve, and let's get Gus on here too, and all of these guys are welcome to come back and join the conversation. But I think we need to spend a little more time on where you were headed, Carl. I believe that we need to do a show on that. Are you game for coming back and joining us for that? Carl might have dropped. I'm not sure.
I had it on mute. I'm sorry. I'd be fine with that, Terry. Like I said, it's just the time has just been really at a premium right now. There's so much happening. So, when would you want to do that?
I've got to look and see what I've got scheduled for next week. If I can't do it next week, we could do it the week after that.
Well, I'd love to have Red and anybody else out there that is as well versed as he is join us, because it's time to get down to the brass tacks. We know what we know, and now it's time to use what we know to make things happen. So I'll leave it at that, and if you want to contact me later, we'll figure out how to make this happen.
Terry, next week is Dr. Jim Garrow.
Okay, so that's what I was thinking. I thought we had something lined up for next week, Jim. Thanks for reminding me of that. So in 2 weeks from tonight, Carl, you want to pencil that in?
Oh,
Vaughn,
okay.
Vaughn, yes. we got about 3 minutes left. I'm going to let you close us out with your final remarks here.
Okay, well, I think maybe the moral of the story is get out of debt and stay out of debt. And I'd just like to reiterate that I'm not a licensed attorney, so I cannot recommend neither for nor against listeners filing land patents, but I've presented information that they can use to make those decisions on their own.
Well, I'm certainly not an attorney, but I believe that everyone at this point had better take every opportunity and educate themselves the best they can so that they can make intelligent decisions how to protect their private property rights. And I agree with you, Vaughn, that those that are in debt had better do everything they can to reduce that debt between now and the beginning of the year, because when the economy starts going south and you're not able to meet your obligations, it's gonna hurt a lot of people. And these banksters don't care about people. They don't care about humanity. They don't care about life. All they care about is their own power, their own egos. They want to be treated like gods, and if they can enslave everybody, that's the way that they think that they're going to go about reclaiming our Creator's creation. And they want to be worshipped themselves, and they want to upset that pecking order, as Red would say if he was still here. Stephen, you still with us?
Yeah, buddy.
Would you close us with a prayer?
Sure. Father in heaven, we thank you for your mercy and kindness to us. We thank you, Father, for the people that have showed up here to share what they've learned. We need your help, Daddy, and we call on you in the name of King Yahshua to help us to learn, to implement what we've learned, and to bless and protect the men that have been here speaking tonight, and Terry for what he's doing, the good work. We love you and praise you in the name of King Yahshua. Amen.
Amen.
Vaughn, thank you so much. You were a great guest tonight. I think you covered this topic very well. John, thanks for joining us. And all the callers in, thanks for listening tonight. We'll see you next week on Walls in Our Minds.
Thank you, Terry.
Good night.
Good night.
because of who